Chapter 12. Tet. In September 1967, John Hart developed detached retinas from playing too much tennis, Nelson Brickham quipped, and was medevaced to the States for treatment. At William Colby's request, RDC Chief Lou Lapham stepped in as acting station chief, juggling both jobs until late November when Hart returned to Saigon, at which point, according to Tully Acampora, Hart fell out of bed and detached his retinas again. 3 weeks later, fearing for his sight, would-be soldier of fortune John Hart left Vietnam forever. In January 1968, Louis Lapham was officially appointed Saigon Chief of Station. Unlike his dynamic predecessor, scholarly Lou Lapham favored classic intelligence rather than paramilitary operations. His priorities, as he articulated them to the author, were the political stability of the GVN, understanding the GVN's plans and intentions, unilateral penetrations of the VCI and COSVN, and RD programs, including Phoenix. Lapham assured GVN stability, his number one priority, by lending to President Thieu whatever support was necessary to keep him in power, while steering him toward U.S. objectives through the use of compatible left parties managed by CIA assets like Senator Tran Van Don. As for Priority 2, Lapham's senior aides secretly recruited Vietnamese civilians and military officers with something to tell us about GVN plans and strategies. Vietnamese nationals working for the CIA did so without the knowledge of their bosses. Their motive, for the most part, was money. Unilateral penetrations of the VCI, Lapham's third priority, were managed by Rocky Stone Special Unit. According to Lapham, this was the toughest thing, getting an agent out in Tay Ninh into COSVN to learn about VC and NVA plans and strategies. But we thought we did. The operation was a valid one when I left in December 1968. Lapham described his first three priorities as strategic intelligence. Phoenix, the other RD programs, and SOG were tactical. Phoenix was designed to identify and harass VCI, Lapham said, while the station kept its strategic penetrations and operations secret. Even though tactical intelligence was not as desirable as the strategic sort, Lapham was careful to point out that it was not always easy to delineate between them. What you get at a low level often reflects a high-level directive. That's why the station has analysts reading captured documents, intelligence reports from region officers, and briefings from interrogators. They put it all together for us, with bits and pieces adding up to reflect guidelines from Hanoi. That's how you do it, unless you can read Ho's reports. When put in the proper context, Phoenix-generated intelligence on occasion had strategic implications, so CIA officers on the Phoenix staff also briefed station officers in liaison with the CIO, and Evan Parker himself attended station meetings thrice weekly. In these ways, the station kept abreast of strategic intelligence Phoenix stumbled on while coordinating its sapper-level programs. Despite its strategic potential, Phoenix was designed primarily to sharpen the attack against the sapper-level VCI. Renz Hoeksema explained how. With a PRU, you don't have controlled sources, and so the information wasn't reliable. That's why I didn't mind Phoenix. It was a way to corroborate low-level intelligence. For instance, a special branch has an informer, say a rickshaw driver, who falls into something and passes the information back. Then we've got to check on it. But otherwise, everybody was too busy with their own operations to check. Phoenix steps in to do coordinating. That's why, Lapham said, the relationship between Special Branch and the PRU is so important. The PRU was the only station means to respond in an operational way to the VCI. When we got hot information through a DIOCC or PIOCC, we could mount an attack. Clearly, in its fledgling stage, when the majority of Phoenix coordinators were CIA officers operating under cover of cords, the program was designed primarily to improve coordination between the station's liaison and covert action branches. It also provided Phoenix coordinators with American and Vietnamese military augmentation and intended to redirect them, by example, against the VCI. However, as John Wilbur explained, Tet put all that in abatement. And Tet was a result of Robert Comer's desire to show success, which prompted him to withdraw U.S. forces from Cong Tac IV, even though General Owen was predicting a major assault against Saigon, and to realign South Vietnam's political forces behind Thieu. This is the strategic political aspect of Phoenix, alluded to earlier by Vietnam's Diogenes, Tullius Acampora, as conducted by the CIO. The CIO, according to Lou Lapham, didn't trust the police and wouldn't leave high-level penetrations to the special branch. And because Thieu and Key were just as concerned with suppressing dissidents as Diem, Lapham explained, there was an element in the police under the CIO for this purpose. Liaison with the CIO, an organization Lapham described as basically military intelligence, was handled by the special unit created by Rocky Stone, which met with the CIA's region and province officers and absconded with their best penetrations. The CIA is strategic intelligence, Howard Rocky Stone asserted when we spoke in 1987. We were more interested in talking than in killing. So in 1967, I set up an intelligence division at the National Interrogation Center with the Military Security Service and with McChristian. Within this division, Stone revealed, I set up a separate unit to select targets, to recruit people with something to tell us. This is the precursor to Phoenix. But when I described Phoenix to Director of Central Intelligence Richard Helms, he said, give it to the military. And the military broadened it into something else. Short, moon-faced, and a member of the CIA's Vince Lombardi clique, Stone said solemnly, this has never been told, but we thought that by contacting North Vietnamese and South Vietnamese communists and giving them secure communications, we could initiate a dialogue toward a settlement. We began negotiating with powerful people. It was only after Senator Eugene McCarthy entered the U.S. presidential race on November 30, 1967, that problems developed. What those problems were, Stone would not divulge, but he did refer obliquely to lines of communication being compromised. He would also like to have the record show that we were close in terms of timing and political considerations. There were potential avenues for political negotiations in late 1967, but when those collapsed, the Vietnamese thought we were delaying. Negotiations became impossible in 1968, and that resulted in Tet. Stone's revelation flies in the face of contemporary wisdom. Stanley Carnot, for one, writes that a settlement was impossible in late 1967 because the communists had been planning a major offensive since the summer that would throw the Americans and the Saigon regime into utmost confusion. Regardless of why it happened, Tet surely did throw the GVN into utmost chaos. On January 31, 1968, thousands of VC simultaneously attacked hundreds of South Vietnam cities and towns, and in the process destroyed the credibility of the American war managers who had pointed to the light at the end of the tunnel. Not only did Tet pour gasoline on the smoldering anti-war movement, hastening the American withdrawal, but it also prompted the war managers to ponder how the VCI could mount such a massive campaign without being detected. CIA analyst Sam Adams suggests that by lulling people into a false sense of security, imprecise estimates of VCI strength precipitated Tet. That opinion is backed by Tom McCoy, the CIA's chief of East Asian political and psychological operations, who quit the agency in November 1967 to join McCarthy's campaign. Said McCoy, LBJ was the victim of a military snow job. Three members of the CIA were back-channeling information, contravening the advice of McNamara, the State Department, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But the directive from the field was to report positively, and the CIA was outdistanced by regular channels of communication. In any event, Tet proved to the world that the VCI shadow government not only existed, but was capable of mobilizing masses of people. From the moment it erupted, Tet revealed, for all the world to see, the intrinsically political nature of the Vietnam War. Even if the U.S. and South Vietnamese governments found it impossible to admit that the outlawed VCI was a legitimate political entity, they could not deny that it had, during Tet, dictated the course of events in South Vietnam. And that fact pushed Phoenix into the limelight. For while operations against the VCI were overshadowed by the military crisis during Tet, in many areas, the DIOCCs were the only places where intelligence on VC military units could be found. At 3 a.m. on January 31, 1968, John Wilbur dragged himself out of bed, grabbed his weapons, strapped on his gear, straddled his Lambretta, and putt-putted from Bien Samoy to Canta Airport. The trip was uneventful, the road empty of traffic, and Wilbur's thoughts were on the dawn raid the PRU were planning to conduct that morning in Kien Thuon province. But when he stepped into the operations center in the CIA's command post, It was like walking into pandemonium. People were going crazy. Everybody was on radios, and all the big Special Forces sergeants who had finally graduated to the C team were walking around with flak jackets and guns. I asked, "What's going on?" One of the sergeants said, "I Corps, 2 Corps, 3 Corps, and 12 province capitals in the Delta are under simultaneous attack. All the calls coming in were from province officers saying, 'We're under attack, we're under attack.'" So, Wilbur recalled, I ran out to the helicopter pad, and here come these helicopters. I think, this must be my operation. So I literally ran out to this helicopter, and the closer I got to it, the closer it got to me. And the helicopter starts landing right on top of me. I was yelling, and you can imagine the noise, "Is this the PRU operation to Kien Tuong?" And the guy said, "PRU operation? Bullshit. We've just evacuated from Vinh Long. The airport at Vinh Long is under VC control." And that, said Wilbur with a shake of his head, was the commencement of Tet. It was the same all over South Vietnam, but particularly bad in Quang Chi, where the province capital was under siege for 5 days and everybody had been reported killed. The first 24 hours were pretty much run on adrenaline, Warren Milberg remarked when we met in 1986. Then the fighting tailed off, and I began to realize that we had very little chance of surviving any kind of massed assault. This is when I began to burn files and make preparations for my death. But Milberg decided to stick it out, even though the province chief climbed on a helicopter and left. I knew if I left the province, which I had the option to do, I could never come back and be effective, he said. So I stayed for 5 days, and somehow I survived. When the Tet Offensive was over, Milberg went on, the month of February was one of cleaning up and trying to resurrect whatever kinds of agent networks you had, of finding out who survived. For Milberg, this meant traveling to Hue to look for Bob Hubbard, one of several CIA province officers killed during the first hours of Tet, when the VC aimed their attacks at the CIA's interrogation centers and embassy houses. Milberg described Hue as a scene of what Germany must have been like during the Allied bombings. I'd never seen anything like it. Fighting was still going on. You heard shots here and there. Some armor units were still in a pitched battle against the NVA in the Citadel. What happened in Hue was pretty traumatic for me, Milberg confided. At one point, in looking through the rubble for Hubbard, I stumbled on a Marine colonel alive and well and looting bodies. I nearly killed him, I was so angry. But I wound up drawing my pistol instead, taking him into custody and driving him, screaming and shouting, to the nearest military police unit. I won't give you his name, but he was court-martialed. Next, said Milberg, I confronted what the North Vietnamese had done in the city of Hue and probably elsewhere. They had lists of all the people who had collaborated with the Americans, and apparently had lined a lot of these people up and summarily shot them. But the most grotesque thing was to find some of the graves where hundreds of people had been pushed in alive and were buried. After a long period of silence, Milberg added softly, "It's the kind of thing I still think about." When asked if he thought the lists used by the NVA and VC in Hue were any different from Phoenix blacklists, Milberg said, "I see a lot of qualitative differences." He would not say what those qualitative differences were. Quantitative discrepancies need explaining, too. The number of persons buried in Hue, as estimated by Police Chief Don Cong Hlap and reported by Stuart Harris in the March 27, 1968 Times of London, was 200. The mayor of Hue, according to Harris, found the bodies of 300 local officials and prominent citizens in the mass grave. Stanley Carnow agrees with these figures, but questions how many of the dead in the mass graves were civilians killed in the retaliatory U.S. bombardment that also inflicted a heavy toll on the civilian population. Journalists allowed to view the graves while they were being opened reported seeing tire tracks and scour marks around the edges. Considering that the NVA did not have bulldozers, this suggested that civilians killed in the retaliatory bombing were bulldozed into the graves. Just as disturbing is a February 1972 article in the Washington Monthly by Oriana Fallaci titled, "Working Up to Killing." Fallaci writes that more than 1,000 people were killed after the liberation of Hue by Saigon forces, including VC cadres, who surfaced during Tet and were identified and killed by the secret police. One person who knows what happened in Hue in February 1968 is PVT, the 1 Corps PRU and Phoenix inspector. The background of this unilaterally controlled CIA asset bears examination. Because his father was a police officer in Hue, PVT was accepted into the Sûreté Fédérale in 1954. When the Americans took over in 1955, he moved over to the Vietnamese Bureau of Investigation, rising through the ranks to become chief of Region 1 in Hue. Unfortunately for his career, his job included investigating the Buddhist immolations, and after the Diem coup, PVT was jailed on suspicion of being Con Lao. Released a few months later, he and many of his tainted Catholic colleagues went to work for the CIA because they didn't like the government of General Nguyen Khang. Intelligent and tough, PVT served the CIA well as a special branch administrator in Nha Trang, Phan Thiet, and My Tho. In 1965, when Nguyen Cao Ky sold the CIA the right to organize counterterror, census grievance, and political action franchises in the provinces, PVT went to work for CIA officer Rudy Enders in Bien Hoa as his special assistant for pacification. A fast friendship formed between the two men, and when Enders was reassigned to One Corps as the CIA's senior paramilitary advisor, PVT tagged along and helped his patron manage the region's PRU, RD cadre, census grievance, special branch, and Phoenix programs. The CIA officer in charge of Hue in February 1968 was William Melton, an older man, according to PVT, hard and mean, who was angered over the death of his PRU advisor. While the battle for Hue was raging, Enders came down from Da Nang to lend Melton a hand. After a quick look around, Enders decided to go after the VCI who had surfaced at Tet. "We had troop density," Enders explained to me, "and we had all these ISICS files, so now we grab hold." Also arriving on the scene at that moment were Evan Parker, Tully Akampora, and General Loewen, who a few days earlier, on February 2, 1968, had achieved notoriety when, in retaliation for the murder of several of his secret policemen, he had summarily shot a VC sapper in the head in front of a TV camera crew. Bringing the same avenging spirit to Hue, Loewen officially sanctioned a Vietnamese participation in Phoenix operations in One Corps when he tacked the ISICS chart to the wall of the Hue City Police Station. But in order actually to grab hold of the VCI operating in Hue, Rudy Enders required the services of PVT, whom he brought down from Da Nang to interrogate VCI prisoners. As PVT told it, he and a small team of five or six people crossed the Perfume River into Hue and went directly to the interrogation center where Rudy left me in charge. PVT and his team then interrogated the captured communists and took photos and fingerprints and made blacklists. Reports Carnot. Clandestine South Vietnamese team slipped into Hue after the communist occupation to assassinate suspected enemy collaborators. They threw many of the bodies into common graves with the Viet Cong's victims. On February 24, 1968, the most bitter battle of the Vietnam War ended, and out of the mass graves of Hue rose Phoenix, its success prompting Defense Secretary Clark Clifford to recommend on March 4, 1968, that Operation Phoenix be pursued more vigorously and that Vietnamese armed forces be devoted to anti-infrastructure activities on a priority basis. One day later, on March 5, 1968, with the Pentagon, hence the armed forces of Vietnam, now embracing the CIA's controversial Phoenix program, Prime Minister Nguyen Van Loc ordered the activation of Phung Hoang committees at all echelons, and he appointed Dang Van Minh chief of a special Phung Hoang task management bureau. Doubling as the special branch representative on the Phung Hoang Central Committee, Minh immediately assigned special branch teams to the most important DIOCCs and PIOCCs on a 24-hour basis and charged them with coordinating intelligence, the theory being that if Phoenix worked in Hue, it could work anywhere. On March 16, 1968, the same day as the My Lai massacre, General Creighton Abrams replaced William Westmoreland as MACV commander. And by the end of the month, Lyndon Johnson had pulled himself out of the upcoming presidential campaign. Warren Milberg, who was on leave in the States, recalled the mood of the country. "I remember coming back and listening to LBJ tell everybody that he wasn't going to seek re-election. That kind of reinforced in my mind the futility of the whole endeavor. It really made a big impact on me. I mean, LBJ was a casualty of the Tet Offensive, among other things." Many dedicated American soldiers and civilians after Tet felt the same way. On the other hand, while demoralizing many Americans, the trauma of Tet spurred others on to greater acts of violence. For them, Phoenix would become an instrument to exact vengeance on a crippled, exposed enemy. Up until the 1968 offensives, Robert Slater writes, the VCI cadre were almost untouchable. Any losses suffered prior to then were insignificant. Confident of almost certain victory during the Tet offensives, however, they surfaced their key cadre. The results are well known. The attacks cost the Viet Cong thousands of their most valuable cadre, including irreplaceable veterans with 10 to 20 years of revolutionary activity. Professor Huy concurred, writing that many agents whom the VC had planted in the towns and cities were discovered because of their activities during the attack and were eliminated by the Saigon government. It is a fact that Tet was a psychological victory for the VCI, but it was a Pyrrhic victory too, for in proving itself a viable political entity, the VCI backed the GVN into a corner. Fear and a chance to exact revenge finally brought Phoenix to the forefront of the GVN's attention. All that remained was for Lieutenant Colonel Robert Inman to bring everyone together at the middle management level. Having served in Vietnam with the Army Security Agency from 1963 till 1965, Robert Inman had already had, like many Phoenix officers, a tour of duty under his belt. Also, like many Phoenix veterans who contributed to this book, Inman is compassionate, intelligent, and more than a little irreverent. At the time I arrived in Saigon in early 1968, he told me, there was a U.S. staff but no corresponding Vietnamese staff. On the U.S. side, there were about 20 people, mostly military, although the key management-level positions at the directorate were CIA. We had two read files, one for everybody and one for the CIA only. The distinction was maintained throughout my tour, but, he chuckled, I got to read the CIA stuff. The reason for the compartmentation, according to Inman, was that CIA coordination with Special Branch continued at a higher level than Phoenix. Likewise, the parallel chains of command extended into the field, with CIA province officers receiving operational directions from ROICs, while at the same time, in their capacity as Phoenix coordinators and members of the Cord's province advisory team, reporting administratively to the Cord's province senior advisor. U.S. military personnel serving as Phoenix coordinators fell administratively within Cord's, but received operational direction from MACV. The CIA-MACV schism was to be narrowed in some provinces, but the gap was never universally bridged. At the time Inman arrived at the Phoenix Directorate, there were three State Department officers on staff, Lionel Rosenblatt, Bernard Picard, and their boss, John E. MacDonald. According to Inman, MacDonald's job was never revealed. Picard, now a prominent Washington lawyer, would not explain to me what he did. Rosenblatt merely said, as a 22-year-old junior officer, I was assigned to Cord's Phoenix in December 1967 and served there till June 1969. During this time, my principal duties were 1. Orientation and visits to DIOCCs, December 1967 until March 1968. 2. Cameron City Phung Hoang Coordinator, March 1968 through September 1968. And 3. Phung Hoang Liaison Officer in Saigon. Executive Director Joe Sartiano, Inman recalled, spent a lot of time with agency officers in the provinces, trying to coordinate the RDCP people who ran the PICS with the RDCO people who ran the PRU under the province officer system. Inman himself was assigned to the operations section of the Phoenix staff, of which he said, there was a unilateral agency effort and a binational effort. And they were separate, too. The Phoenix Reports branch under Lieutenant Colonel Lemire was headquartered not in USAID 2, but in the old embassy building on the river. Nothing was computerized, Inman stated. It was all pens and pencils and paper. There were, in addition, a plans and training section under Lieutenant Colonel Ashley Ivey and an administrative section under CIA Officer James Brogdon. As for the mood of the Phoenix staff, according to Inman, the problem on the U.S. side was that cynicism was developing. Gooks, slopes, dinks, you didn't hear those words in the Saigon office, but the attitude was there. This racist attitude generally belonged to proponents of unilateral operations, as opposed to people, like Inman, who wanted to hand the job to the Vietnamese. There were definitely two sides. He sighed, adding, a lot of people after 3 months said, why should I waste my time with the Vietnamese at the national level? I can get into the special branch files and I can run the PRU, so what the hell? When asked if this was due to legitimate security concerns, Inman responded, lack of security was often just an excuse for incompetency. Inman did not blame Evan Parker for the bigotry evident to the Phoenix Directorate. Parker was not paternal, he said, but he had reached a point in his career where he was functioning more on a diplomatic than an operational level. And Ev had frustrations with his own people inside the CIA who viewed the RDCP and RDCO systems as competitive. Each side would say, yeah, talk to them, but don't tell them too much. No one wanted to divulge his sources. There were other problems with Phoenix. For example, Inman commented, one province in Three Corps was relatively pacified, and the province senior advisor there thought Phoenix would only stir things up. He thought his 95% HES, Hamlet Evaluation System rating, would drop if they started looking for trouble. The problem, Inman explained, was that the U.S. had tremendous resources, enough to fund 25 programs, all first priority. Bigger pigs and better rice, and Phoenix. Now, some province senior advisor simply said, there's no way to do it all, and picked one or two to focus on, and not always Phoenix. The other major problem, Inman said, was that Phoenix was used for personal vendettas. When Inman arrived at the Phoenix Directorate, Evan Parker's military deputy was Colonel William Greenwalt, an administrator trapped in an office. Inman and his best friend on the Phoenix staff, Lieutenant Colonel William Singleton, concluded that the CIA had Greenwalt there to take the rap if anything went wrong. What went wrong was Greenwalt's career. Greenwalt was slated to become a brigadier general, but by virtue of his association with the CIA, via Phoenix, his career jumped track and he retired as a colonel when his Phoenix tour ended. Operations was run by a civilian, Inman recalled, a retired full colonel on contract to the CIA. His name was William Law. He'd been the military attaché in Laos. Singleton and I were assigned to Law, and Law told us to review everything in the files because he didn't know what the next step was going to be. After a month, it got to be a drag, so I complained to Greenwalt. I said, I want another job. I'm wasting my time. Greenwalt relented. He gave me and Singleton three or four actions, which we resolved in about an hour, Inman recalled, and shortly thereafter, Law was sent down to the Delta to be the CIA's contact with the Hua Hao. Law was replaced by George French, a very personable, very experienced CIA officer who had done some very dramatic things in his career, from the OSS to Cuba. George French's first job was as a demolitions expert in an Arizona lead mine in the years before World War II. For that reason, he was recruited into the OSS's Underwater Demolitions Unit in 1943 and assigned to Detachment 404 in Ceylon. Over the course of his CIA career, French did tours in Korea, Turkey, Pakistan, and Saipan, and, as a member of the CIA's Special Operations Division, in Laos, Cambodia, and elsewhere. In the summer of 1967, French was assigned to Three Corps as Bob Wall's deputy in charge of PRU, even though he actually outranked Wall. Nor did he appreciate that Wall acted like a dictator, so he asked for a transfer and was assigned to the Phoenix Directorate, replacing William Law as operations chief. French described the job as mostly traveling to the provinces to see what was going on and asking, how's your body count? The rest of the job, he told me, was just paper shuffling, compiling information and passing it on up to MACV. In March 1968, the Phoenix Feng Huang program began to gel. Passing up the opportunity to manage the Soviet-Russia division with Rocky Stone as his deputy, William Colby instead had returned to Vietnam at the request of Richard Helms to serve as acting chief of staff of Cords. Because he was too overbearing to communicate effectively with the Vietnamese, Robert Comer needed Colby to work with Interior Minister Tran Tien Kim in formulating counterinsurgency policy and procedure at the national level. Colby understood Vietnamese sensibilities and knew enough about the country to select and assign Cord's advisors where they were needed most. He also understood the dynamics of the attack on the VCI, that Phoenix advisors were needed specifically to help local authorities develop card files and dossiers modeled on the Diem-era ABC system. In the process, Colby was to achieve infamy as the man most closely associated with Phoenix and as its principal apologist. At the time I arrived, Inman recalled, Parker was meeting with Colby and Kim, developing proposed action programs, writing documents, and sending them down. Kim was saying yes to everything, but nothing was happening on the Vietnamese side. So I went to Greenwalt and asked permission to contact some lieutenant colonels and majors in the Vietnamese Ministry of the Interior. Greenwalt said okay, and I approached Phan Huy Nong, my counterpart during my first tour, and the J-7 Special Intelligence Officer to the Joint General Staff. No, sent me to see Lieutenant Colonel Loi Nguyen Tan, the action officer for Phoenix at the Interior Ministry, where he had a desk, but nothing coming in. Here it is worthwhile to pause and realize that one reason the Vietnamese were slow in creating their own version of the Phoenix Directorate was their difficulty in finding a suitable translation for the word infrastructure. To solve the problem, President Thieu appointed a commission consisting of senior American and Vietnamese intelligence officials. Attending as an interpreter-translator was Robert Slater. After 5 lengthy and rather hot, both in temperature and temperament sessions, Slater writes, a decision was reached that the term that was presently in use would be retained. The Vietnamese term was hạ tầng cơ sở, meaning the lower layer of an insulation or the underlying foundation. According to Slater, this misinterpretation was the crux of the problem in the Allied attack against the VCI. If the South Vietnamese government cannot get across to the South Vietnamese people the danger of the VCI through an adequately descriptive word, then how can they hope to combat them? The crux of the problem, of course, was not a lack of understanding on the part of the Vietnamese, but the fact that the Americans insisted on defining the VCI in terms that conformed to their ideological preconceptions. Ed Brady put the problem in perspective when he explained that for the Vietnamese, committees at lower levels are the infrastructure of any higher-level committee. In other words, village committees are the infrastructure of district committees of province committees, and so on ad nauseam. According to Brady, the word infrastructure drew no distinctions at all, and whatever level the VCI existed at depended solely on each individual's own semantic interpretation. They were writing documents, Inman said, and sending them down for translations, but no one understood what the word infrastructure meant, and no one dared to go back to Kim and say, I don't understand, Tan said to me. What is this infrastructure? They were looking it up in the dictionary and coming up with highways and electrical systems and such. I said, it's their leaders. And Tan said, oh, Can Bo, Cadre, that's what we call them. What Thieu's National Commission could not resolve in 5 days, 2 lieutenant colonels resolved in 5 minutes. Next, Inman said, Tan introduced me to a major who was Thieu's personal chief of staff. Tan, this major, and I sat down and wrote up Thieu's presidential directive. Then this major got the papers to Thieu. The papers were issued in July, and Tan moved into the National Police Interrogation Center with about 10 senior people from Special Branch as Kim's man in charge of Phuong Hoang. Chung Tan Hu, a former precinct chief in Saigon and before that, Nha Trang police chief, was assigned as the senior national police officer. Major Pham Van Cao became the day-to-day manager of the Phuong Hoang office, and I spent the next 8 months there as liaison to the Vietnamese national-level staff. A self-proclaimed true believer in the right of the Vietnamese to settle their own affairs, Inman had little to do with the U.S. side of Phoenix. I was mostly at NPIC headquarters, he stated. My role was as salesman. I'd check in with George French for 30 minutes in the morning, sometimes only once or twice a week. I'd get input through him from a lot of people. He'd say, sell this to the Vietnamese. I channeled policies and directives and manuals from French, all in English, over to Phuong Hoang office, and they translated them. Then I spent time getting everybody to read and understand and sign off on them. I'd run them past Census Grievance and RD, Field Police and Special Branch, the Interior Ministry and ARVN, and everybody would sign off. And that is how the Vietnamese Phuong Hoang office got its marching orders from Colby in the Phoenix Directorate. The other reason why the Vietnamese were slow in creating the Phuong Hoang office concerned the struggle between President Thieu and Vice President Ky, a struggle that in 1968 reflected changes in the relationship between America and South Vietnam brought about by Tet. The first signs of realignment appeared when President Johnson withdrew from the presidential campaign, at which point his influence in Saigon began to wane. Johnson, however, remained committed to a negotiated settlement because success at the bargaining table was the Democratic Party's only chance of getting Hubert Humphrey elected. But Republican candidate Richard Nixon seized the issue and used it to subvert the Democrats. The darling of the Kuomintang Finance China lobby, Nixon, through intermediaries in Saigon, persuaded Thieu to postpone negotiations until after the elections, assuring himself the presidency of the United States at the expense of prolonging the Vietnam War. Reflecting these developments in Washington, a similar political realignment began in Saigon in May 1968 when the VC initiated a second wave of attacks on Saigon, and Thieu, writes Professor Huy, as usual had no quick response. But Ky did react decisively. He tried to mobilize young people for the defense of Saigon and received a favorable response. With Tet, said Tully Akampora, Loan made a comeback. Thieu was in another camp, watching and waiting. Through February, the attacks increased, and by May, with a second offensive, Loan thinks he can walk on water. Then he gets shot outside of MSS headquarters, and that's the beginning of the end. It's all downhill after that. On May 5, 1968, General Nguyen Nhoc Lon was seriously wounded and quickly replaced as Director General of the National Police by Interior Minister Kiem, who appointed his own man, Colonel Tran Van Pham. Next, writes Professor Hui, Thieu began his plans to weaken Key. His first move was to dismiss Prime Minister Luk and replace him with Tran Van Hung, a former mayor of Saigon and a bitter enemy of Key's. During the 1967 elections, Key had coerced peace candidate Trong Dinh Tzu into pressing blackmail charges against Huang. And so, as soon as he was appointed prime minister, Huang tasted sweet revenge by dismissing most of Key's backers in the administration. Then, writes Hui, Key received a new blow when several officers loyal to him and serving in the Saigon police were killed at the beginning of June in Cholon during their campaign against the second attack of the communists. They were killed by a rocket launched from an American helicopter. Apparently this was a mistake, but many people thought it was due to the American decision to help Thieu against Key. The incident occurred on June 2, 1968, when a rocket fired from a U.S. Marine helicopter gunship malfunctioned and slammed into a wall in a schoolyard on Kwang Tou Street. The wall collapsed, killing seven high-ranking officials who had been invited by the Americans to the battlefront in the belief that the VCI leadership was hiding in the home of the Buddhist leader, Chi Kuang. Killed were Pho Quoc Chu, Loewen's brother-in-law and chief of the Port Authority, Lieutenant Colonel Dao Ba Phuc, commander of the 5th Ranger Battalion, Lieutenant Colonel Nguyen Van Luan, Saigon Police Chief Major Lay Nguoc Tru, Cholon Police Chief and Loewen's personal aide, Major Nguyen Nhoc Tsing, Combined Security Committee and 1st Precinct Police Chief, and Major Nguyen Bao Thuy, Chief of Staff to Lieutenant Colonel Van Van Qua, Loewen's brother-in-law and the Mayor of Saigon. 4 days later, President Thieu appointed Colonel Tran Van Hai Director General of the National Police. On the same day that he took office, Hai dismissed Key's 8 remaining police chiefs in Saigon and replaced Special Branch Chief Nguyen Tien with his friend Major Nguyen Mao, who refused to accept Phoenix within the Special Branch and instead incorporated the Combined Intelligence Staff with a new Capital Military District Command, CMDC. A byproduct of Tet, the Capital Military District was formed for 2 reasons. To organize better the resources against the VCI cadres that had aided VC sapper units during Tet, and to regulate the 500,000 refugees produced during Tet and pouring into Saigon. It was also with the creation of the Capital Military District that Thieu and Kiem wrenched control away from Key and Loewen once and for all. Encompassing Saigon's 9 precincts and Jia Ding province, the CMD had as its American counterparts MACV's Capital Military Assistance Command and a Feng Huang Committee in 1st Precinct Headquarters. Prior to the CMD, Phoenix personnel from Jia Ding province had patrolled Saigon's precincts on a circuit rider basis. As of June 1968, Phoenix advisors were placed in DIOCCs in each of the precincts. Phoenix precinct advisors reported to Lieutenant Colonel William Singleton through his deputy, Major Danny L. Pierce, whom Robert Inman describes as an active Mormon who traveled all over the country on Sundays holding services. In this capacity, Inman informs us, Singleton and Pierce were involved directly in intelligence and reaction operations in the back alleys of Saigon. CIA operations in the Capital Military District, aka Region 5, were managed by a series of veteran CIA officers under their cover boss, Hatcher James, the senior USAID advisor to the mayor of Saigon. Headquartered behind City Hall, the Region 5 officer in charge monitored all Phoenix operations in the Capital Military District. A few days after the CMD was created, General Nguyen Khac Binh was appointed director of the CIO and quickly conferred upon Station Chief Lou Lapham a charge from Thieu to run intelligence operations anywhere in the country, going after the big ones. With Key's people in the grave or the hospital, President Thieu began to shape the government of Vietnam in his own image, appointing ministers, police and province chiefs, and military commanders who would do his bidding. Also, by issuing Law 280, Thieu lifted the monkey off the U.S. Embassy's back, and in return, the Americans looked away when he began persecuting domestic opponents whose compatible left political organizations fell under Law 280's definition of VCI cadre. From July 1968 onward, the task of ensuring the GVN's internal security fell to General Tran Kien Kim, who, according to Dan Van Minh, was the real boss of administration and intelligence. CIA asset Kim, serving as Interior Minister, Deputy Prime Minister for Pacification, and Chairman of the Feng Huang Central Committee, thereafter worked hand-in-hand with William Colby in steering Phoenix into infamy. With the promulgation of Law 280, which compelled Vietnamese corps commanders and province chiefs to organize Phung Quang committees, and 1 week later MACV Directive 381-41, which ordered U.S. military and civilian organizations to support Phung Quang, Phoenix was ready to run on both its American and Vietnamese cylinders. All that remained was for Lieutenant Colonel Inman to spread the word. "One of my principal functions," he said, "was to take Tan, polished and above it all, and Cao, blunt and offensive, to visit the PIOCCs and DIOCCs and give a pep talk. I probably visited every district in my last 8 months. But," he added, "it was not my job to sell Phoenix to the U.S., so we didn't announce our arrival. The district senior advisor wouldn't even know I was there. My job was to sell Phung Quang to the Vietnamese, and I stayed on the Vietnamese side." The people saddled with the chore of selling Phoenix to the Americans were the Region Phoenix coordinators, field-grade military officers who began arriving in Vietnam in January 1968. Their role is discussed in Chapter 14. But first, some statistics on Phoenix through August 1968. No aspect of Phoenix is more significant than its impact on civilian detainees, and despite the increase in the number of CDs after the GVN's acceptance of Phoenix in July 1968, the construction of facilities capable of holding them never materialized. Instead, hardcore VCI were transported from mainland camps to Con Son Island, and four mobile military field courts were authorized in October 1967 to supplement the four courts authorized in 1962. Confirmed VCI were tried by province security committees, whose proceedings were closed to the public. The defendant had no right to an attorney or to review his dossier. Security committees could release a suspect or send him to prison under the Antri administrative detention laws or to a special court. Due process for CDs remained on the drawing board. Nevertheless, in compliance with Law 280, the four Vietnamese corps commanders, General Hoang Zam Lam in one corps, General Vinh Loc in two corps, General Nguyen Duc Thung in four corps, and General Nguyen Cang in three corps, formed joint Phoenix Phung Quang working groups and corps-level Phung Quang committees, bringing the military and police into varying degrees of cooperation, depending on the commander's personal preferences. For example, Lieutenant Colonel Lemire reported that General Cang was reluctant to support police-type operations with military resources. Cang assigned a mere captain as his regional Phung Quang coordinator. In I Corps and II Corps, Lemire noted, the cordon and search using Phung Quang blacklists appears to get the best results. In IV Corps, the PRU is still the main action arm. In III Corps, the PRU Police RFPF District Operation seems to be most productive. Everywhere, the degree of Vietnamese participation in Phoenix rose steadily. By August 1968, Phung Quang committees existed in 42 provinces and 111 districts. 190 DIOCCs had been built at an average cost of $15,000 each, and 140 were actually operating, along with 32 PIOCCs. A total of 155 Phoenix advisors were on the job. However, confusion still existed about the proper relationship between PIOCCs and Phung Quang committees. In some provinces, the two were merged, in others they were separate, and sometimes only one existed. Many Phung Quang committees had no relationship at all with DIOCCs, which were often viewed as an unrelated activity. The change in name from ISICS to Phoenix to Phung Quang added to the confusion. In Pleiku Province, the ISICS Committee became the Phoenix Committee but met separately from the Phung Quang Committee. Everywhere, Americans and Vietnamese continued to conduct unilateral operations, and tension between the special branch and the military persisted as the biggest Phoenix-related problem. The other major problems, cited in a May 1968 report written by Corps Inspectors Craig Johnstone and John Librand, were lack of trained DIOCC advisors, lack of agreement on the definition of the word infrastructure, inadequacy of reaction forces at district level, the exception being when PRU were sent down from province, improper use of field police forces, torture of prisoners, lack of a standardized filing system, poor source control mechanisms, lack of coordination between Phoenix and other free world forces, and census grievance participation in Phoenix. To facilitate Phoenix operations nationwide, the CIA issued two handbooks in June 1968. The first, a 31-page document titled, The VC Key Organization from Central Level Down to Village and Hamlet Levels, outlined the VCI for Phoenix operators. The other was the Phoenix Directorate's first Manual of Procedures, outlining the program from Saigon down to the DIOCCs. At this point, a detailed picture of the estimated 70,000 VCI was emerging, targeting was becoming specific and scientific, and results were improving. Lieutenant Colonel Lemire reported that, as the DIOCCs and PIOCCs have refined databases, gained experience, and mounted more operations against targeted individuals, the neutralization rate has been well over 1,000 per month for the last 4 months. In Jiading Province, Lemire reported, the combination of an aggressive province chief and a dedicated Phoenix coordinator has more than quadrupled the monthly rate of killed, captured, and rallied VCI. Much emphasis was placed on neutralization rates, which were deemed the only objective way of measuring Phoenix success. As reports poured into the directorate from all over the country, numbers were tabulated and scores posted. By the end of June 1968, more than 6,000 VCI had been neutralized, with exact numbers available from each DIOCC so Phoenix managers could judge performance. As Evan Parker explained it, you've got people, you've got some sort of structure set up, some facilities and money and resources. Then you need a record-keeping system. Unfortunately, he added, people live on reporting. In order to get brownie points, a guy would say, we conducted X many Phoenix operations, and that looks good on your record. But simply because they were ordered to conduct sweeps, they might pick up some VC, but they could just as easily have been soldiers as civilians. Whatever the results were, it was conducted in the name of Phoenix. A lot of things were done in the name of Phoenix, and this goes into your record-keeping system. Ralph Johnson writes, it was this reporting weakness which for a long time attracted much of the foreign press criticism of Fung Hwang. Then, Parker groaned, Comer took it one step beyond and assigned goals for the number of VCI neutralized. Comer was a great one for setting objectives, then keeping score of your performance against these objectives. And this is how quotas got developed in the summer of 1968. Borrowing military kills to meet Comer's quotas was more than inflationary. John Cook, the Phoenix coordinator in Xian District in Jiading Province, in his book, The Advisor, notes that switching the identity of a VC soldier killed in combat with that of a known member of the infrastructure meant that, if at a latter date the real member was captured or killed, this action could not be reported, for you can only eliminate a man once. Comer didn't understand the police nature of the attack against the VCI, Bob Wall said scoffingly. When LBJ put pressure on him, he invented quotas as a management tool, and this destroyed Phoenix. Quotas gave starving policemen a way to feed families. It let them bring in bodies and say they were VCI. I resisted like mad the idea of quotas, insisted Evan Parker, because I felt this would lead to cheating, or in innocent people being arrested, and this looking good on the quota. Or there might even be names listed on arrest reports that didn't even exist. In one area, I was told they were taking names off the gravestones. But, he sighed, they had quotas, and they tried to meet quotas, and that's how you get the idea that this was some sort of murder organization. Indeed, Phoenix was labeled an assassination program, evoking the specter of war crimes and leading many people to minimize the impact of quotas. I think it was moot, Warren Milberg said. It was something I just ignored. For the most part, it was coming to you from people in Saigon who were going home at night and sitting under the veranda at the Continental Hotel. You just didn't take that stuff seriously. They couldn't relate to what you were doing, just like you couldn't relate to what they were doing. It was a different war. It was a different part of the world. Another Phoenix coordinator, a CIA Czechoslovakian desk officer sent to Bien Hoa province in 1968, saw comparisons between Phoenix and Gestapo attacks in World War II. For him, the reports I sent in from my province on the number of communists that were neutralized reminded me of the reports Hitler's concentration camp commanders sent in on how many inmates they had exterminated, each commander lying that he had killed more than the other to please Himmler. Why one person remained silent and went along with Phoenix while another spoke out against it is the subject of the next chapter.